Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the On the Spot series by China Forum. In this series, we return to the platform of international forums and webinars where leading minds in academia, government, business, technology, and media deliver novel, collaborative responses to the global issues of the day.
Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. I'm Sun Chenghao from the Center for International Security and Strategy, Tsinghua University. Today we are joined by Mr. Wang Zicheng. Zicheng started his career at Xinhua News Agency, where he spent 11 years, then joined the Center for China and Globalization, a non-governmental think tank in Beijing in 2022. However, Zicheng is perhaps most better known for his newsletter Pekingology, which is probably the first English-language newsletter on China's current affairs, written by a Chinese professional from within Chinese institutions. With now over 23,000 subscribers, many outside China have grown familiar with and, shall we say, intrigued by his work. Today he's back in Beijing and shares with us his experience and unique insights on communicating China's stories to the outside world. Mr. Wang Zicheng, welcome to CISS.
Wow, thank you for having me here. And shall I say, it's a great privilege to be here. And I also want to start by acknowledging, I think this is perhaps the only English language podcast run by a Chinese think tank. And I think that shows, you know, CISS attaches great importance to international communications and also your wisdom in recognizing this as a unique and very effective form of communicating, you know, your messages. So again, thank you for having me here.
Okay, thank you very much for your encouragement for our work here. And so in your Twitter or X bio, you describe yourself as, quote, self-anointed journalist posing as a think tanker. Why?
Well, I think maybe I wanted to convey three different meanings. First of all, as you generously described, the overwhelming majority of my career so far for 14 years, I spent 11 as a journalist. So that is a, you know, hint at my previous occupation. And secondly, I now work at a think tank, the Center for China and Globalization, a non-governmental think tank in Beijing. But I also write some newsletters, including, you know, Pekingology, The East is Red, and CCJ Update. So although I don't have any press credentials, I used to have one from China. And when I was based in Brussels, I had one with accredited by the European Union, but I don't have one anymore. But still, I think what I do now is a kind of journalist. And the third and finally is, I think actually a lot of think tank work is another form of long form journalism. So yeah, that's what I basically wanted to say in the short sentence up there in the bio of my Twitter account.
Okay, very interesting experience. So some people say that rather than describing China to the world, what is needed is translating China to the world. Your newsletters are widely popular among Western audience. Do you think it is because you have translated China successfully? And have you found any secrets that you can share with us?
Oh, you are so kind, and I would not say they are like widely popular. Yes, we have maybe several tens of thousands of subscribers, but overall, that's still maybe an influential, but still a very small audience. And actually, I think the number one reason is actually, it's quite simple. It's because you and I, we have identified the means of basically communicating via emails. And that's something very, very common for people living outside China, but many people inside China in this line of work haven't come to realize that. Is, you know, foreigners, not just Westerners, but people outside the People's Republic of China, they use emails just like we use WeChat. So they, whenever an email arrives, they have push notifications on their smartphones, on their iPads, on their, you know, laptops. So this is something people constantly pay attention to. So that is why I think, you know, using email deliveries is actually quite important. And I'm very glad Substack, the platform, now makes the job much easier. And so it enables us to do email-based, you know, delivery in a much more smooth and cost-effective way. And on the content, I want to add a little bit on the previous question is that actually translating the firm Chinese documents and leader speeches or policy discussions is not exactly super easy. You know, a lot of phrases used in China, including its political communications, if you just translate it literally word by word verbatim, probably doesn't convey the sophisticated nuances that the domestic speakers want to say. You know, for a number of reasons, sometimes it's purely language, sometimes it's because of the historical and political background here. So I think what I do is maybe 80 or 90% of what I put out in Pekinology and then at the East is read at CCG is translations. So what I do and, you know, together with my colleague, I have one full-time colleague, Ms. Jia Yuxuan, who is fabulous. We identify Chinese public discussions and put it into English. I think it boils down to what kind of content we actually pick from a wide array of available sources. And so different people have different choices. For example, I think you focus in China Affairs Plus on, you know, China's international relations, its foreign policies, but maybe I do have some of that content, but maybe my primary interest in Chinese domestic affairs. And I think it's a combination of judgment of my previous professional training and experience at China's state news agency, as well as my reading these days, and based also on, you know, we read Western press and think tank researches on a regular basis, and we have a sense of what people are talking about, what they are interested in. So combining these different knowledge and, sometimes it's just instinct. So to identify what kind of interest or what interesting content that I should publish. I would not say there is a coherent, uniform set of standards around which I choose content, but it's more out of instincts. And I'll put it that way.
Right. It's not easy to translate, and it's also not easy to have some original article published on our platform. I hope in the future I can invite you to write some original article for us for China Affairs Plus. Okay, so nowadays China is always the center for discussion, but the voices from China remain peripheral. So why is it, and what do you think we can do about it?
Well, in one sense, you know, the Chinese economy is the second largest in the world. Its military might has been growing rapidly. It has 1.4 billion people, perhaps the largest, middle-income groups in the world, 400 million of them, with increasing international influence. That is a fact. And but on the other hand, China's rise, China's international links is a relatively recent phenomenon. And, you know, China embarked on the path of reform and opening up only around 1978, so until now it's less than 50 years. In the grand scheme of things, that's still quite recent, and we speak very different language. And outside China, the long the international discourse has long been dominated, first and foremost in the English language, and secondly by other powers that have already risen before China, you know, the United States, the Great Britain, and others. So I think it's quite natural. It's not something that, you know, we Chinese should always blame ourselves. I think that's just what happens. And what we should do, in keeping with, I guess, two thoughts. First of all, it's like in the Chinese tradition, we always say basically we should examine ourselves first and then maybe have some expectations of others. And secondly, in the prevailing, let's say, Chinese political philosophy, in Marxism, we say internal factors are the driving, are the primary, are the fundamental factors of things. So what we should do, in my personal opinion, is we should lower the barrier, lower the threshold, lower the requirements for the outside world to understand ourselves. So we should not become, our own worst enemy, and for others to understand China, we should make it easier. We should, you know, allow more foreigners to come to China, enable them to access Chinese materials, Chinese thinking in a costless way. And maybe as individuals, I would say, within our, you know, framework, where, you know, in our studies, in our employment, we should have the courage to take more initiative on our personal basis, whether by, you know, starting a Substack as you and I do, did, and or maybe starting a podcast, or maybe just getting on social platforms and beginning saying something. I think this is all the things that we can, and I'm glad to see more and more people are actually trying to do that, and out of their own personal volition. Yeah,
right. I think the world is full of bias, but what we could do is to provide more information to the outside world. Exactly. as much as we can. And that's back to your personal experience. You have a total of 11 years of experience as a journalist in Xinhua, one of the most recognized state news agency in China, then run popular newsletter on China's affairs, and then working at a non-governmental think tank, still running the newsletters. So is it safe to say that your motivation has not changed throughout the years, which is to tell the China story better? Has anything changed for your newsletter between your Xinhua years and now at CCG? And do you feel any difference between then and now?
Well, on an operational basis, I would not say much has changed. Actually, I think little has changed. I was and I remain fortunate to have employers that didn't interfere with basically what I put out. And so whether it was in my previous employment or at my current one at the Center for China and Globalization, led by, you know, Henry Huiyao-Wang and Meibao Miao-Lü, they don't actually tell me what to put out or what not to put out. I think for a long time, readers, they actually know, like, for example, when it comes to Pechnology, 23,000 of them, and when it comes to the East is Red, 13,000 of them. Like, it's actually these platforms platform very few content originating from either Xinhua or CCG, the Center for China and Globalization. So it's not exactly a tool used by my previous employer or by my current employer to publicize themselves. What I do and what my colleagues do, with the blessing of my previous supervisors and current supervisors, is to make it as a platform that helps other reasoned, credible, or what I believe to be valuable information from other Chinese institutions, including here at CISS, at Tsinghua, at you know, National School of Development, at Peking University, at you know, various Chinese media outlets and WeChat blogs. I want to serve as a platform, you know, to give them some help, my limited help, to reach more people, and in that sense, to help others, including many, well, most out of the, since the newsletters, most of the subscribers are, you know, not Chinese mainland nationals. So for them to have a better, more comprehensive understanding of China. When it comes to the first part of the question, you mentioned, you know, tell China's stories well, tell China's stories better. This is a slogan in China for quite some years. My personal understanding and maybe my expectation for that is to, you know, this is a very powerful, a very simply written sentence. It could have very different connotations and meanings. My understanding is to tell China's stories truthfully, in a more comprehensive, in a more real, true, in a more multi-dimensional way. So that means the progress that China made, that means the enormous challenges that, you know, the People's Republic of China, its governing party, its government, and its people face. And we should do with utmost capabilities within our reach. And, you know, we also have enormous limitations, but to try to, again, enable, you know, our audience to have a more comprehensive, more real, and a more multidimensional view of what is happening in China, what kind of public discussions is happening inside China.
Yes, I totally agree with you that we should tell China story truthfully. And but we often hear Western media complaining about a lack of Chinese perspectives on China-related matters. At the same time, we also hear Chinese scholars argue back that it is the Western world that refuses to listen. So what's your take on this interesting dilemma? Have you personally experienced any challenges in your lines of work?
Actually, what inspired me in the first place to start Peknology, which was May 2020, and I seriously got to develop that in towards the end of 2020, which is now 5 years later, was that, yes, there was a substantial, serious, extreme lack of Chinese perspective on China-related matters in English in the international discussions. Back then, there were already some Substacks. There was, you know, Cynicism by Bill Bishop, the number one Substack around China. But none of the many Substacks were written by any Chinese mainland professional, especially if they work in, you know, Chinese institutions, including state-run institutions or Chinese universities. So that actually is a gap I wanted to, you know, to narrow. So that's the primary reason I got on Substack. So I do think, and I want to basically return to something I said a little bit earlier here, is that I think as Chinese institutions, as people who have some sort of discourse power within China, at least within our very small, you know, area and field, we should make it easier for the Chinese, you know, our colleagues, ourselves, our students, our interns to you know, meet foreign visiting scholars and think tankers and consultants and even diplomats to make this experience as easy as possible. I think it goes without saying, and for many of the listeners here, and we should truthfully acknowledge that the barrier of communicating, especially directly, has grown, you know, it's become more difficult, and we should have the courage to recognize that. And that is not the right direction, in my understanding. And but I'm very glad to see, you know, both, you know, you, me, and the CISS, and there are many, shall we say, far-sighted individuals and institutions that are trying to make it easier. And on the other hand, I do think, like, some of the international, you know, media reporting and analysis on China, on Chinese affairs, from the observation of you and me, may seem a bit, let's say, it's a bit foreign. It's a bit wrong sometimes in views, and that's unavoidable. I think most of that come from, you know, just different understanding of facts on the ground, from their long-held beliefs about the, you know, China as a country, as a society, as how its politics, its economy, its society are wrong. And some of that is probably driven by some, you know, motivations that are not exactly, you know, in our views, very fair. So, again, it's always very difficult to correct, you know, quote unquote, correct others' behavior or attitudes. So I think first and foremost, for what we can do is to make our own efforts to, you know, to help broadcast our messages, our analysis on, you know, all kinds of Chinese matters, and also make it easier for them to understand. And, you know, it's what our prevailing political philosophy tells us. It's what our, you know, traditions tells us. And I think it's also demanded by the reality that we are facing now.
Yeah, right. I think CIS has always encouraged young students to engage more with the international friends.
Exactly. You have really fabulous events.
And we also have our project of CISS Strategic Youth. And I also lead 2 student delegations to visit Switzerland and US with your help to connect many friends and institutions there. So the younger generation sometimes still feel frustrated about the current geopolitical tensions around the world and the Western world's view on China. So if you can leave a message, what do you want to say to them?
I would hope, like, for people a little bit younger than our generation who have a passion, who have some interest in what we do, in what they are going to do. First and foremost, I would hope they have a more accurate and comprehensive understanding of our own national facts is China is huge. It has 1.4 billion people, but its GDP per capita, a euro measurement of wealth, of income, is only $13,000 a year. That's something like 70th in the world. Actually, it's on par with the lowest member of the 27 EU member states in the European Union. I think several years ago, a senior Chinese leader was publicly remarked that 600 million Chinese citizens have a monthly disposable income of less than 1,000 yuan, which is about $150. And yesterday or 2 days ago, I saw like Huang Qifeng, the former mayor of Chongqing and a very well-received public intellectual in China, also repeating something similar, like, there is still enormous gap for China, for Chinese people to get better, to improve our own living standards. I think we should always keep that in mind, is in our, you know, trying to understand China and trying to interact with the rest of the world. You know, what others think of China is actually much, in my opinion, much less secondary, less important to how exactly we develop our economy, improve our income. This is the most important thing. I think Chinese leader has repeatedly said, and I think the governing Communist Party of China has also taken it to heart, that the top priority is to manage our own affairs well. And that is the fundamental, the fundamental thing that, you know, everything China, you know, the Chinese government does. And that actually touches on the lives of you and me, of our parents, of our grandparents, of our maiden neighbors. So I think to have a good understanding of what is happening in China, what are the challenges, are the shortcomings that we are facing, this is very important. And secondly, I think we should have the confidence that if we believe that we are on a right track, that China's rise is inevitable, or it is sustainable, or the economy is well, in the long run will get better, well, with people's living standards more improved, then we should have the confidence to engage and to confront baseless accusations, and so to have a more courage, but also with facts, with reason, with logic, rather than political rhetoric. And so always ground our arguments, ground our messages in facts, in logic, in our unique national conditions. And I think with China's rise, with the I think what is going to be a relatively long period of adjustment in the minds of many of our American friends, of our friends in the West, and also try to contain the potential conflict, manage our differences well in a calm way, because peace is extremely important. Conflict and war is very costly. It's not in China's national interests. I think this is also what, for example, CISS has been doing in running some track to dialogues on AI, because potentially, if not managed well, it could have very dire consequences for China-US relations, for the international landscape. To resolve, to manage these issues from a perspective that is directed towards peace, towards peaceful coexistence, towards prosperity. This is not a zero-sum game, and the world is not a zero-sum game. I genuinely believe that, and I think Chinese senior leaders have repeatedly said that, and I'm very confident they genuinely believe that, is that we are going to find a way to manage the geopolitical tensions, build our national strength, but at the same time, exist and share, the Chinese market, the Chinese technology, Chinese know-how with many partners in the world, not just in the global south, but also increasingly in what we say Western industrial nations, with Chinese investment and coming with Chinese investment, Chinese technology. the employment of local people by Chinese companies. And I'm sure, you know, with our, you know, joint effort and with the wisdom from people, not just in China, but also outside China, we'll be able to achieve that.
Yes, right. I think I totally agree with you that to understand China and the world better, and only achieving this can we communicate China's stories to the outside world by providing more facts and numbers.
Yes, and I sometimes, you know, what I publish on Substack on technology and the East is Red actually includes a lot of critical discussions of China's matters, including by, you know, various professors at Tsinghua, at PKU. And I would love to see more, you know, basically just treating the problem, treating the challenges as they are, and talking about them in an openly, in an honest, fashion. Because a lot of these things are not necessarily a product of a, you know, of a system, of a policy. Many of them are just, you know, because we rose from a very thin, you know, material and development stage, and we are a huge country, you know, with uneven development. That's just the challenges along the way. And to have these discussions, I think it also serves for the outside world to understand China, that it is not a behemoth, a giant creature that's getting very scary. It has its own problems to tackle. Domestic situation is always the priority. China doesn't want to, you know, impose its system, its culture on the world for a number of reasons. And very important of them is that we still have a lot of problems to solve in our own society.
Right, right. Thank you very much. And that was Mr. Wang Zicheng, who shared his journey and his reflections on bridging China's story with the world. Thank you for listening. Please stay tuned for more CISS podcasts.